Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Yay.
Lost in the Static.
Yay, welcome to violence. We should just open a show where you and I are just beating the hell out of one another.
Oh, you mean like Brad and Jared over the My Little Pony movie?
Exactly. You know what took a lot of work? The Holocaust.
I was with you guys?
You don't understand. I was listening.
That took multiple takes because after that, Jared and I started laughing so hard. Where he picks up, that's a totally different take.
I was driving in the car listening to that episode on my iPod, and I damn near drove off the highway when that happened. You almost killed a co-host with that joke.
I'll tell Brad that.
But something that is no joke.
And speaking of butts. And things that can go in your butt.
Exactly. AdamandEve.com. My favorite little promo code that you use at the very end is static. And if I buy a product that I really, really like and I happen to use static there at the very end, what do you get?
I don't know. You do the whole promo.
No, I don't. Okay, fine. You get 50% off of one of your items.
Correct.
You get 3 free adult DVDs.
Yep.
Plenty of spank material right there. You get free shipping.
Yep.
You get a koala bear.
Nope.
No koalas?
Well, you might. It's a free mystery gift. I don't know if they give out koalas.
That's true. You do. You get a free mystery gift.
We talked about this on What the Fuck once. Now, wouldn't it be awkward if the stuff is not gender-based and it's just purely random and, like, you know, a chick orders a big dildo and it comes with penis enlargement cream or cock ring? I wonder if they look at, like, the name and, okay, that's a guy, send him a guy product.
I don't think they do.
So we talked about that on What the Fuck. It was just,
but nonetheless, you get a free mystery gift, you get free shipping, 3 free adult DVDs, and you get 50% off of one of the items that you decide to choose. And you get the nice little satisfaction of helping me and Josh keep the lights on.
Yes, you are helping keep the lights on, and that's exactly what it comes down to.
And again, when you're checking out, just use the code STATIC. Thank you very much, and thank you everybody for using that. So today we were going to address something that
More than one listener has requested,
and I really think it's something that within the U.S. at least needs to be addressed because
it's dying
very quickly, and that is literature. I can't necessarily say books because, like I said before, I'm dyslexic, so I get a lot of my books on audio, so I listen to a lot, and I have to admit, and this will make more than one listener go aw, but there have been a very few number of books that I haven't been able to find on audiobook. But when we do come across one that I really, really want to read or really, really want to hear about, and we can't find it on audiobook anywhere, my wife has very lovingly been willing to read to me.
See, what I like? I don't have a whole lot of books on CD. I've got actually books on cassette. I've got Clive Barker's Everville, which I've never gotten around to reading.
Yeah.
I can listen to that in the car. Sure. I've got some Ray Bradbury ones. I got some Star Wars novels.
And you know what I love about audiobooks too is when they're read by their authors.
I give George Lucas a lot of shit over the Star Wars movies.
Yes.
The one thing about this, at least the modern iteration of the Star Wars books on tape, books on CD thing, right, one of the advertising things uses authentic music and sound effects from the movies.
Yeah.
So literally, it's less like hearing a book read to you and more like listening to a radio play.
Definitely. And the BBC, they did a wonderful job with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Not only did they do the original radio play of Hitchhiker's Guide, but a few years ago, well, more than 10 years ago, they did a radio play version of all 5 of the books. All 5 of the books.
All 5 of the real books or the ones that came after his death?
Well, there's only one that came after his death.
I've heard people bitch about just how...
It's not him, but it's not bad. That's another one I found on audio, not on Radio Play, but on audiobook. But nonetheless, it's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, primary phase, secondary, you know, tertiary, quandary, and quintessential phase. And it was actually aired, I think it was BBC Two, Radio Two. I'm not sure. I don't quite remember. But I've got those on MP3, and I really enjoyed them. But nonetheless, literature, I think, is a dying thing. And really, for me, part of the reason why literature is dying is because a lot of the schools don't push reading like they used to.
Well, it's because, and I know I already know you're going to disagree with me on this. It's because of things like a Kindle. That, well, you know, yes, it's a book, but it's on your little fancy electronic dealy. I'm sorry. I've tried to read off one of those that a friend had. It's not the same experience as holding a book, feeling the pages. For whatever reason, I absorb the book more when I'm holding the goddamn book than when I'm reading it on a screen.
Surprisingly, I don't disagree with you. When I do read, which, again, can only be a few pages at a time, before I have to take a break. But if I'm traveling and I know I'm going to have a lot of downtime, especially if I'm traveling for work or something like that, and I know I'm going to have downtime, I'll take a book with me. And you're right, there is something to holding and reading that book, an actual book. But at the same time, I'm not going to discourage reading on a Kindle or on an iPad or something like that, because to me, reading is reading is reading.
If I had a portable EMP generator, I'd go and zap every fucking person I saw reading off a Kindle, and I'd throw them a copy of the paperback.
See, and I don't. If you want to do that, I'm all for it, because to me, the reading is the important part. And frankly, when it comes to comic books, one of the things that I am able to read, and get through an issue without going cross-eyed.
Because you got the pictures accompanying it?
Because I got the pictures accompanying it, because there's a little bit. So I do like graphic novels, and I think that iPads and stuff like that have done a lot of good for trade paperbacks, but
comic books.
Yeah, comic books.
You used the GN words.
Comic books and illustrated novels, ha ha ha, and stuff like that, collections. And I like it. I even like it on the iPad, because I've got one. I think it's Marvel was who did it, but they give out free iPad versions of classic Marvel comic books every now and then. And it's kind of cool, because you can kind of zoom in on a square and really study the art, and then move the panel over and move on to the next one.
With the comic, you hold it closer to your face. That's a manual zoom in.
Yes, but this is. It's the art is a lot cleaner than in, say, if you pick up a well-read comic from 1976, it's lost some of its luster over the years. But to see it on so,
but that newsprint look, you know, that newsprint look, it's the same thing that I've said for years about Blu-ray looking too clean on some movies, that they're too clean on Blu-ray. That's the way, like those old 70s comics, when they're digitized, even though the art's the same, it's too clean.
I understand where you're coming from, but to me, the most important thing is reading. And I've done this with my nephew, I do it with my niece, and the younger people in my family, where I will sit down and I will read with them, even if it's, you know, See Dick Run and that kind of stuff, which my nephew is just starting to read, so he's kind of at that level. But to sit down with them and read with them, and to instill a true love of books. I didn't really get a true love of books or literature until high school, when I met a friend who...
That's something I've got over on you for once.
Yeah, yeah. I met a friend who runs a used bookstore. Used bookstore, if anybody happens to be listening in Muncie, Indiana, it's called White Rabbit Used Books. Go and say hi, Derek. Go and say hi to Derek and tell him I sent you. And I was surrounded by this stuff, and he really showed me things. And he was the one that instilled in me a love of classic literature that high school never did.
Define
high school
classic.
Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn.
I have lots of problems with those. Yes, I know they're classics, but they're also boring as fuck.
But you know, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, Shakespeare.
Oh, I got so many issues.
I know you got issues with them, and even classic sci-fi, like some of the Harlan Ellison stuff. Some of
I love that shit.
Some of the Isaac Asimov novels,
Bradbury,
and then we move into one of my absolute favorite authors of horror, Cthulhu series.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Thank you. Oh my God.
Howard Philip Lovecraft.
Yes, Howard Philip Lovecraft, and that kind of classic stuff, as well as the something you might find on Brows Held High.
Well, which is something you brought up, H.P. Lovecraft. There's things like, you know, him and Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard, yes. In that. There's something that. You get so many people that, you know, I've read the comic books of Conan. Why do I need to read the novels and
whatnot?
Because
they're very different.
They're so different in a way that is, I'm going to come across wrong no matter how I say this. I'm going to come across weird. And
okay, go right ahead.
I'm going to get in trouble. But they're too sanitized. The old versions, H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, and Edgar Rice Burroughs were Klansmen.
Yeah.
There are so many. I mean, if you look at like a Conan novel, an original Robert E. Howard Conan novel, blacks are basically just this side of talking monkeys.
Yeah.
And that's always sanitized. And I'm not saying I think that about blacks. Obviously, I do not. But that's part of the story. And when you read it in the comic book, it's not the same thing.
Well, the other one that gets me was... With Huck Finn, you had that movement. You're supposed to read Huck Finn in high school, and that movement to remove the word nigger and
slave Jim.
Yes, slave Jim. But the part of literature and part of studying literature and part of learning to love literature is seeing the times that it. You know, obviously, you read a Shakespearean play. And you go, man, we don't talk like this today. And if this were in modern linguistics, then yes, it would be extremely different. But because I read Shakespeare, because I learned these lines, because I learned and loved these characters, I have an appreciation for a time that I didn't exist in. And when it comes to Huckleberry Finn and things of that era, guess what? The word nigger was common. In fact, it was common clear up through the 80s. And so my deal is, yeah, you can teach that, hey, guess what? If you go over to, you know, Tyrone's rib place and come bursting in and go, hey, niggers, you're going to get in trouble. But at the same time, you have to appreciate and understand the linguistics of a time. And the word nigger, being in Huck Finn, it was linguistics and common use of the time. So fucking deal with it.
Well, and then you made me think of something else. There's also an entire style of writing that is lost, even when these things are translated to comics or film or TV or even like stage plays. And that is a style of writing that literally, I won't say it doesn't exist, but is almost non-existent today. And that is what younger people are not even going to know this off the top of their head, but what we call pulp style. The old pulp adventure serials of the 30s. The men's adventure stories of
yes.
the 40s and 50s,
yes.
that type of pulp writing. It was never meant to be high art. It was meant to give a good old thrill to its reader for the 10 cents that they paid for that,
exactly.
that pulp book.
Exactly.
And that style is gone today, partially because of hubris and people like us who go, you know, we would see, let's say a modern style pulp story is written in some anthology. We would go, God, this thing's so poorly written. The characters are paper thin. We would pick it apart.
Right. But at the time, you know, especially the old chapbooks of the Western stories, even going as far back as the time of Charles Dickens, and, you know, he always published in chapbook stories, which you would get a chapter or two at a time, and then it would come later and later and later. And
serialized.
Yeah, serialized. And that's where a lot of this pulp writing comes from. The Adventures of Jesse James, back when Jesse James was still alive and they were writing
another thing about the pulps is the reason that they were in some cases so overly descriptive, and you know, they would describe action rather than character in that, you got paid by the word.
Yeah.
So the more words you used, the more money you made. And usually you only got a half cent a word if you were lucky.
Right.
And you know, Hartland Ellison told this story about how when he started to sell his stuff in the late 50s, he was making enough that there was a spaghetti restaurant right underneath the apartment he had, which for $1, you got to remember, that was not the cheapest in the 50s. For $1, you got a huge meatball, a plate of spaghetti, and a soda for $1. For almost 4 months straight, he ate at that place every night because that's all he could afford for what he was making, selling his stories at half cents a word.
Right.
You know, you got to remember, just because you're published doesn't mean you're making money, man.
Right. And I think that really it's becoming, yeah, we still have Barnes & Noble. We still have Giant bookstores.
But Amazon. Barnes & Noble's not even a bookstore anymore. They're a coffee shop, and they DVDs and stuffed toys. And
board games and everything else. And, of course, Amazon built its business on books initially. And now Amazon.com, you can get just about everything. But one of the things that I always admired, one of the friends, there's Derek, who ran the bookstore, and then there was my friend Dane. Dane was blind at the time and ran the video store upstairs.
Yeah,
Dane had a daughter, and they're going to kill me next time I see them because I can't remember her name. But she, one of the things that she really looked forward to was she would finish up elementary school and then go over to Derek's bookshop and pick out a book and just sit there and read. And she would go through, gosh, even everything from, you know, Harlequin romance novels, which are, you know, absolute crap.
I think that's the definition of trash.
Right.
Writing.
But she would go through anything from Harlequin romance novels to the works of Shakespeare to Edgar Allan Poe to H.P. Lovecraft to just about anything you can imagine. And she probably went through 75 books a week just going in and reading. And that to me is a very, reading is an important skill to learn, not just because you can read it all the time, but I like reading things online, reading Facebook posts and stuff like that. And when I read it, I can see the humor. I can read the humor into it, mainly because I know the person posting. But I think that that's also, if you don't read enough, that you get exposed to these different kinds of inflection within an author's voice, then you lose it online. And that's where a lot of misunderstanding comes from. Todd Sheets and I had an exchange online where we were both joking, and I didn't think he was joking, and he didn't. I didn't think he was joking, and I didn't think
the other one was serious.
We each thought the other one was serious, and we each thought the other person was serious, and it ended up going in completely the wrong direction, and almost ended up an online fight. But I think that if you read enough, I don't even care if it's comic books. If you read enough, you learn to inflect.
Well, and see, I like the fact that things like Harry Potter got a whole new generation of kids to read books. Okay, my problem, and this is where I'm going to get a little arrogant, I really wish it were something better than Harry Potter that got these kids to read.
Like what?
I really wish, like, instead of finding Rowling, these people had discovered Ray Bradbury. Or something that was smart and not, look, wizards and magic, and we can, you know, we can do it because I said so, and that's because magic exists. And I wish these kids would have found something a little more that was more stimulating for their brain.
But
that's arrogant on my part. I know that, but that's how I feel.
But at the same time, Josh, if they start reading because of Harry Potter, and then they discover Ellison, or if they discover any other author. You know, that to me, it's, you know, how they always say that marijuana is a gateway drug, which is another topic altogether. Well, to me, if Harry Potter is your gateway book, great, get started enjoying it. I'm glad that you sit down and you enjoy it. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of kids went, well, what else is out there? If I enjoy Harry Potter this much, what else is out there? And that's where they can find all of these other authors.
Well, you know something that really makes me feel good when I'm going through like a Goodwill or something and I'm looking through the books? You find some old like 1980s paperback, you know, some old printing, and the spine is all broken and the pages are dog-eared. And you look at that and you go, this book has been read dozens and dozens of times. That kind of makes you feel good. That this book has probably been passed like a doobie at a party. Yeah. Around from one person to another. That makes you feel kind of good.
Well, it's like my wife has a very, very well-loved copy of American Gods by Neil Gaiman. In fact, she has four of them because three of them have been have just literally disintegrated from her reading them. And as far as I guess what I'm saying is I don't care what kids read, but I really hope that they're still reading.
Well, see, my problem, this is not arrogance. This is as long as it's not Stephanie Meyer. Because, no, I have not just problems with the gay vampires or Jillian turned me on to the term. She calls them sparklepires. I'd never heard sparklepire before. But the problem that so many kids are reading Stephanie Meyer and they're not realizing she is a god-awful author. Her prose style. She doesn't use punctuation. I mean, it's almost like her stuff has never had an editor pass over it. Because her stuff is so over blunt or overly descriptive. You got bad uses of words, bad style. Her stuff is terrible, and yet that is the new measurement. Instead of at least the Harry Potter books on a technical level were well written. The Stephanie Meyer stuff is not, and that should not be the new benchmark, yet it is becoming such.
Well, I heard a literary critic who was talking about Stephanie Meyer, and he was about our age. I think he was mid-30s or so, and he said, for my generation, Stephanie Meyer is writing at a fifth or sixth grade reading level.
Yeah.
That's what she's writing at. He says, for the current generation, and I hate to say this, but he says, for the current generation, she's writing at about a sophomore in high school level.
Which is still pretty bad.
Which is still pretty bad. But again, if all they can stomach is Stephanie Meyer, then they're still reading. They're still reading, and that's the one little scrap of hope that I'm hanging on to.
But that type of reading is making them worse readers, because then if they do run across like George Orwell, they're going to go, this is boring, this is dumb, I don't understand half the words he uses.
Yeah, but they're still reading, and it's still, you know, okay, maybe you go from Stephanie Meyer to step up to Dr. Seuss, and then you step up there until you reach
that. That's a big leap from Meyer to Dr. Seuss. I think C. Dick Run's got to be in between there.
And by the way, that's one of the things, if we have any aspiring modern authors listening to this, one of the things that I really appreciate and one of the things that I think is going well, and this is one thing that Stephanie Meyer did right. She didn't do
marketing.
Much. She didn't do much right, but she did this right. If she wrote to a kid's level, which is what Twilight is, let's face it, it's
yes.
Teens and tweens, more tweens and preteens, but if they wrote to them, she didn't talk down to them. Neil Gaiman in Coraline, the Graveyard Book, and a few other of Neverwhere and a few other of those teen tween audience that he obviously was shooting for, Graveyard Book even younger by his own admission. One of the things that he does as an author is he doesn't talk down to kids.
Clive Barker didn't do that with he wrote children's books.
Yeah. You know, and that I have a lot of respect for. And Theodore Seussel, Dr. Seuss, did the same thing. He never talked down to kids. He wrote at a kid's level, but he never, you never got the idea that he was stooping over to talk to the kid. He was kneeling down and talking to them eye to eye.
Well, I mean, now, again, this is probably going to show a little arrogance on both, because I have a feeling you're going to agree with me on this one, is one of the problems with not just modern literature like in the 2000s. I'm going to say modern literature within our lifetimes, okay? I'm going to encompass modern literature into our entire lifetime, so almost 40 years, is the fact that the trash always seems to outsell the smart.
The trash has always outsold the smart.
I mean, Harlan Ellison once said on the Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder, he's not one of those people that always, oh my God, my books aren't selling, but it does offend him when Jacqueline Suzanne outsells his highly intelligent novels by 14 times. That is sort of insulting to the human race.
The trash has always outsold the smart. Always. Let's go back to the Mozart's day. You had his high operas that he wrote for the royalty and for the upper class. And then you had the common operas, such as the Beggar's Opera, such as the Magic Flute, and a few others that were for the common man. And they were the pulp trash of the day. And it has always outsold the smart. The reason the smart doesn't sell is there aren't that many smart people anymore.
I can't disagree with that.
You know, as awful as that sounds, the truth is the trash is always going to outsell the smart. But still, to me, in my eyes, again, I don't care if it's a Harlequin romance, you're still reading, you're still getting involved, and I don't care what you read, but whatever you're reading, it does engage the imagination. Even in comic books, how many times have you been lost in a comic book and the panels kind of start to move and animate on you? That's happened to me.
Well, and the same thing happens. Have you ever...
Okay. You know, or reading Harry Potter before I saw the movies. I had this one, my imagination kicked in and I had this beautiful picture. I got to admit, the movies came kind of close to what I had in my brain. But, you know, or Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, stuff like that. I had these beautiful, wonderful pictures in my brain and I was engaging my imagination. Part of when I read with Tony or with Jenna, my nephew or my niece, I always, we take a break when I need to, since I can only get a few pages done, and we keep our imaginations going. I'll have Tony describe to me what he sees when I read this, or he'll ask me, he'll stop me and he'll be like, "Uncle, what's this character look like?" And we engage each other's imagination when we talk and we describe these things. And that is something that reading and literature does that no movie will ever do.
That brings me to something else. This is not what I was going to say before, but the problem with when they make movies out of books, and this has been something, this goes back to the 70s and probably prior to that, where they usually re-release the original book, right? You know, to coincide with the movie. And one thing that always bugs me is they use the movie's poster or Yeah. Where you've got I Am Legend by Richard Matheson being re-released with Will Smith on the cover.
Yeah.
And it's the movie that they saw is nothing like the book they're about to read.
Right.
That's pure false advertising. I mean, I've got a copy of Pierre Boulle's Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston on the cover. Other than the basic outline, there's no similarities between that book and that movie.
But you know what? That's marketing at work. And I don't care. Because if somebody sees Charlton Heston on that cover or sees Will Smith on the cover of I Am Legends and picks it up and reads it, that's the important part to me.
But to me, the problem is it's disingenuous to the reader because they're going to go in going, oh, the character of Neville in I Am Legend is going to look like Will Smith. And then you get the description and the, well, he's a big white guy with a beard? Wait, no.
Well, you know, yeah, okay.
It sullies the actual novel.
But any time you make a movie or a visual representation of a purely literary art, you're going to ruin somebody's idea.
There's one case I can think of where that absolutely did not happen. and that is Blade Runner. While Philip K. Dick died before Blade Runner was completed, one of the last things he did in Hollywood is he got to sit through like a 15-minute reel of the special effects of the cityscapes and everything.
Okay.
And the special effects guy said this is the greatest honor he's ever been given in his life. He said Dick came out of the screening room, and he thought he was about to get yelled at by Philip K. Dick. And he goes, I don't know how you did it. That's exactly what was in my head when I wrote this book. And you exactly picked up on everything in the book visually. It is perfect.
Good. Good. So it didn't ruin Philip, but maybe somebody who read, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, maybe it did for somebody else.
Which is kind of strange, but to me, that's like the special effects guy reading that book 20 years after its publication got exactly what Dick was trying to get across.
And that's good filmmaking.
Well, and we also have to talk about filmmaking a little bit in this. There's something, this happens more with science fiction and horror than it seems to with action or drama.
Okay.
Why can certain books, they've been translated to the screen 2-3 times and never properly? What is the deal that you keep wanting to bring this to the screen, but for whatever reason, you can't seem to do it right? Philip K. Dick has been raped by almost every movie since 1982 that's come out that's tried to, quote, I'm doing air quotes, adapt his stories.
And well, Philip K. Dick is a weird example because a lot of his stuff, a lot of the stuff that he writes is very psychological, and it really deals...
Because he usually wrote while on LSD.
Yeah, but it deals with the inner brain and with your own psyche, and it's really, really hard to take somebody's brain and throw it at a movie screen and get it right. And because, again, these novels weren't... They were written with the imagination in mind, not the cinema.
Okay, I see that, but I'm just saying, like I Am Legend. So far, of the three official adaptations of that, none have gotten it right. And I've heard that there's a rumor that they're going to try again. Why? You're just not going to get it right either.
Right.
No one wants to actually adapt a book. They say, we want to do this, and we want to add our own little this.
Well, yeah, there's, you know, they want to add their own stuff. There's budget constraints. There's studio constraints. There's all this stuff that's going on that's constraining it. But I say keep trying and keep failing and keep making people read the book.
Maybe. Okay, what I was going to ask you before was, now, this might not apply to you, and I don't mean this as an insult, but with your dyslexia,
sure,
you probably have not encountered this, so this is more of a question to the audience, is, have you ever been so lost in a book that time stops for you?
Yes, I have.
You know, that literally all of a sudden you look up, and it's 3 hours later, and you felt like that much has gone by, and you've just been absorbing this book. I did that with Harlan Ellison's Mephisto in Onyx. It's a novella, so technically it's not a book, but you know what I mean.
Right.
I read that entire novella in about three and a half hours. I started reading it about a half hour before I had to go to work. Next thing I look up, I'm late for work. I haven't called in. Just, I could not put the novella down. I had to keep reading to know where this story was going.
Well, again, this is back in high school. After high school, I went over to White Rabbit Used Books, and I don't remember what book it was off the top of my head, but it was one that Derek really enjoyed.
Science fiction? Horror?
Yeah, it was science fiction, and it was one that Derek really enjoyed. And so I went into the bookstore, and I was looking around, and he goes... And he knew my disorder, and he just said, hey, would you mind if I read you a little bit of this? I'm really enjoying this story. And I said, yes. And if I remember right, it was a Philip K. Dick book.
Yeah, he only wrote 50-some novels, so it could be one of
anything. No. Breakfast of Champions, Kurt Vonnegut.
Okay.
It was Kurt Vonnegut. And I sat down, and Derek started reading to me, and... Derek's mother was English, and language and working with stuff like that was really beaten into Derek as a child. And so he was an excellent reader, and even more so, he was an excellent reader when reading aloud. He was an excellent storyteller.
Okay.
And I'm saying was, if he's not around, he is.
I hope so. You told people to go in there and say hi to him.
Exactly.
Unless we're on an episode of Ghost Hunters.
But he is. He's an excellent storyteller. And as I was sitting listening to him, the next thing I know, my mom comes bursting into the bookstore.
Where the fuck have you been? Yeah,
where have you been? And all of it, and Derek looks down and he's like, you know, I'm sorry. Cause it was like 8 or 8:30 at night, and you know, I never came home from school and all of that. But just listening to Derek read, and I've gotten lost. I do that with audio. Stephen Fry's version of Harry Potter, the English, the European release, not the U.S. release. Stephen Fry wrote, and Stephen Fry is just such an excellent storyteller that
Harlan Ellison, I get lost in it. Whenever he does his own, I don't know. I haven't listened to a lot of books on tape that are written or read by the real authors, but like Ellison changes his voices for the different characters, and he, you know, kind of does like a funny when he's trying to do a girl voice.
Stephen Fry and Neil Gaiman do the same thing. Neil Gaiman's another one that I can get lost in.
And see, then there are some that on a certain level, you go, okay, this is kind of trashy, even though it's by a big author, or in the case I'm about to bring up, a big author under a pseudonym.
Right.
But that just engage you and yet never seem to be the author's most thought of work. And that to me would be like Richard Bachman, who most of you will know under his bigger name of Stephen King.
Right.
The Bachman books, I couldn't put those down.
You're talking about The Dark Tower and...
No. He wrote those under Stephen King. Okay, the Bachman books were The Running Man, Rage, Roadwork, and The Long Walk. I'm not counting Blaze or any of the later ones. This is... He wrote these when nobody knew Stephen King and Richard Bachman were the same guy.
Okay.
That this is when Richard Bachman was the secret guy that nobody knew of. They're great. For one thing, and I don't know why Stephen King felt the need to do this. He says this was an unconscious thing he did. Three of those four Bachman books I just mentioned are science fiction, something you don't think of Stephen King for.
Right.
So I don't know if he finally felt like, you know, I'm free of the constraints of being Stephen King, so I can write science fiction for once, and people will accept it when they might not accept a Stephen King science fiction story. I don't know. He said that wasn't conscious. That was just... That just turned out to be the ones he did as Bachman. Three of the four turned out to be science fiction based. But The Running Man, Roadwork, Long Walk, and Rage, you can't put those down. They're fucking great.
Well, when The Green Mile was first being published, The Green Mile came out in chapbooks. What were they? They were little skinny books.
My son has those. Yeah, it's like a dozen of them or so.
Yeah, there's a dozen or so. But I remember when they came out on each one, my girlfriend at the time and I were both reading them, or she was reading them to me sometimes and stuff like that. And that's another one that we got lost in. And for me, Stephen King is really hit and miss.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes really when he's on, he's on. Yeah, like but when he's off, he's off. Yeah,
the Dark Tower series, when they engage me, I am in that world. I'm with the Wanderer, and it's amazing. Then you have things like Pet Sematary, much better movie than book.
Well, and then that also brings up not just talking novels. There's also short stories, which not only are they much easier to digest, but sometimes they fool you into reading them when you wouldn't otherwise. Like, do you realize that... Children of the Corn by Stephen King was first published in Penthouse
as a short story.
Yeah. It sort of fools you. You're reading an adult magazine and there's, oh, this thing by Stephen King. What the hell?
Well, again,
you might never have read that if it were in an anthology.
Exactly. And during the heyday, well, that says something about Playboy and Penthouse, because during their heyday, especially Playboy was highbrow stuff in there, and there still is on occasion, but
yeah, well,
not as much.
You know, Penthouse actually had so many science fiction stories submitted to it, they actually said, let's just start another magazine. And that's how Omni was spun off. Omni was a spinoff of Penthouse.
Yeah, he never would have imagined
because they basically said, we got so many science fiction stories, that's basically all we're being submitted anymore.
Right.
Let's just make our own magazine for these.
Right. And
Omni was born.
Omni was born. And but getting back, now I know why, what is it about Shakespeare that you don't like?
First of all, it's ungodly pretentious. And even for its time, it was ungodly pretentious. One thing is possibly the fact of all of how it's elevated, how everyone, well, it's not Shakespeare, you know, this new thing, it's not Shakespeare. Oh, it's never going to be as good as Shakespeare. Read those Shakespeare stories totally out of the context of this is motherfucking William fucking Shakespeare. Just read them as stories by some anonymous author. And you would go, these are fucking terrible. They're utterly predictable. They're terribly written. The characters are paper fucking thin. It's like they're just, I can't stand. He's as bad as Stephanie Meyer in my mind.
But,
and I know that just made a ton of enemies.
Yeah. Get out of my house. But no, I have immense respect for the Bard for the simple reason that, yes, some of his stories plot-wise, Romeo and Juliet, not his best work.
One of his most recognizable.
Again, one of his most recognizable. Again, relatively thin characters, you know, relatively predictable plot, even toward the end, simply because there's been so much of it done. I think it's just kind of ingrained in people's brains anymore. So if you look at it from a true critical standpoint, I would agree with you. But there is the way that he plays with you're saying take the author completely out of context, and I'm saying take all that bad stuff completely out of context and just look at the way that he plays with language, with the way that he crafts things. And yes, this is obviously not something you can do with a middle schooler, but you know, look at how he plays with the written word, and it's incredible what he can do with language. Midsummer Night's Dream, Hamlet, that the whole to be or not to be soliloquy by Hamlet
himself.
Which
is what I consider just pretentious, that I am so much better than you. I have the words you cannot summon.
And the truth is, Josh, I hate to say it, I don't find it pretentious, because the way that he plays with the language, the way that he plays with word, this is pure genius. And yes, he had the words and you didn't. And you couldn't write it.
To quote Bart Simpson, today's modern super writers could outwrite William Shakespeare in a minute. Stephen Bochco could just kick Shakespeare's ass, to quote Bart Simpson.
As far as plot and some in the way of character development and
dialogue.
And dialogue. But there's a reason why those dramatic elements of Shakespeare have become cliche, is because they have influenced everything, including your beloved modern authors. And I'm saying, if you take all of that cliche away and you just look at how he plays with the word, there is no modern writer that could hold up to him.
See, I absolutely disagree with that, but that's just a point where you and I are going to have to
disagree. And yeah, that's one.
Otherwise, we're going to end up fighting over My Little Pony.
Exactly. But the simple fact is, I really do. I see him as genius. I also see Mark Twain as genius. Mark Twain's comedy... And a lot of people see it as down home and hokey and just as cliche. There's a reason. It's because everybody hit it. It hit a nerve with everybody. And it worked.
Well, but then you've also got all these quote-unquote classic books that, okay, nobody is ever going to be able to convince me Steinbeck's Old Man and the Sea is not the most pretentious, ridiculous symbolism. You know, that he wants you to know, I am best smarter than you. I am better than you. Nobody's ever going to convince me that's not the point of Old Man and the Sea, is that I'm a better fucking writer than you and I am smarter than you.
And that made
so goddamn, like Glass Menagerie and Death of a Salesman and these kind of things. These are just painful books to me.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. But again, the reason that they're painful is because... the pretentiousness is there, and it's there for a reason.
You know, I mean,
but at the same time, there's a reason why everybody knows Death of a Salesman. There's a reason why people know this.
That's partially, I think, because they're taught in schools and you're forced to read it.
Yeah, and but I'm not saying that they are awful, but I'm not saying that they're really good, and I'm certainly not saying don't read them in schools. The reason I'm saying read them in schools is because, yeah, they're kind of hard to get through, but they do have a lot about human character to teach.
I disagree. I think, and I'm not saying this as a science fiction fan, I'm saying throw that shit out the window and grab like Ray Bradbury, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Not only is it going to hold their interest much more, it's a much more interesting story, it's much more well-written, and will get you to those same places of the depths of character. But science fiction, especially in literature, has this weird stigma of sci-fi, you know? It's like goofy robots and explosions and shit.
Yeah, it's for kids.
You know?
I agree. I agree with you there. And I guess my message to school is, yes, Death of a Salesman has something to teach. Yes, Old Man and the Sea has something to teach about human character. But by forcing these works, I wish that there was a school that would go, okay, this semester for English, you have to read 10 books.
Well, Scott, I did not get my diploma in a normal manner, okay?
Okay.
I had to take... I got my actual diploma. I did not get a GED.
Okay.
But I had to take an online course. You got to remember, this is early 90s online, so we're talking real antiquated shit. And I had to read 3 books. And I have no idea if this was just dumb luck or if they used like the example I said of Ray Bradbury. The books I had to read were Speaker for the Dead, The Foundation by Asimov, and Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles. And I'm going, did I just fucking luck out? 3 awesome fucking books are the ones I have to read to get my fucking English credit. Are you serious?
And somebody else is going to look at those and go, those are awful. There are people out there who look at science fiction and go, I just can't get into it. I can't. But again, you throw a good romance in front of them, and I'm not talking Harlequin here. You heard me say a good romance. You throw a good romance at them, which I look at and go, ugh, and they're going to absolutely love it. And I guess that's what I'm saying is, to me, I don't care what you read. It's important to me that you do read. It's important to me that you exercise your imagination. And I think it's important that even if you don't like Shakespeare, even if you don't like Faulkner, who can be extremely difficult to read, because he loves the semicolon. Even if you don't like The Great Gatsby, which is a book I can't stand.
It's pretentious garbage.
But I'm glad I read it. I'm glad I studied it. I'm glad I looked at it, because there are bits of literature that The Great Gatsby influenced, and I can see that influence. I can see where it came from, and I feel like in some modern writing I have a little bit better understanding of what's going on because I've read those pretentious garbage classics that you say are pretentious garbage. I think it's very important to have it, get into reading by enjoying it. So read whatever you enjoy, whether it be science fiction.
But here's
or
the problem
whatever.
with reading in school, whether it be high school or college, is the teachers seem to elevate certain things to a level that was never intended, or they start seeing things that aren't there. Have you ever seen the movie Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield?
It's been a while, but yeah.
Okay, there's one part. He has to write a huge thesis on Vonnegut. So he actually hires Kurt Vonnegut to write the thesis for him. And he gets an F, and the teacher goes, I don't know who you paid to write this, but they don't know the first thing about Kurt Vonnegut. And that is perfect the way, you know, I had English teachers that would read all this symbolism and, oh, you know, he's suppressing his psychosexual need to do this and all that. And in the cases where the author was still alive, they go, none of that's in there.
Yeah, and
you're just reading into this.
And that to me doesn't mean that there's a bad author.
No, no, no. But I'm just saying they try and teach things that aren't there, which gives the students the wrong look at the author, so they're not reading the book or the story correctly. Because they're reading a tainted version, if you will.
And that to me, it can be. That's why I think schools can solve it this way. Okay, kids, for this particular bit of class, I want you to go find a book where the main character goes through this trouble. And if you find me a book where the main character goes through this trouble, and we talk about it in class, and we look for the common themes, and we look for the things that they should be teaching in literature. For instance, one of the most amazing things is back in the day when people were executed, they weren't merely just hung until dead. This is back during they were publicly shamed. They were hung, and then their head was chopped off. You know, they were castrated. Their head was chopped off and put on a pike for all to see. And this is, I forget exactly when, but it was centuries ago that this happened. But they always had a chance right before they were hung. You know, the executioner would say, "Do you have anything to say? Do you have anything to confess?" And people always looked for the confession. And Shakespeare, in his writing, all of his characters that are evil in his plays, every single one of them has a confession.
Well, I mean, basically,
every save one. And that's Iago from Othello. And Iago, you know, we don't know why Iago is evil. And a reason is never given. And when he is asked for a confession, he simply says, "You know what you know." And it's shit. And it's because I could read Shakespeare that I can see this. And even in modern literature, bad characters go, "Well, I did it because of this." Until you run across those ones. Serial killer in the 90s, the Green River Killer.
Okay, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, the Green River Killer, when asked for a confession, not only did he give details in the case, but when somebody said why, he gave Iago's answer of because it had to be done.
Well, and you also made me think, I'm being a half snide on this, but Shakespeare's characters with all that confession and all that. Have you ever noticed the villain is basically a Bond villain? They always confess their evil plans and this is how I did it.
Well, that was theater in the day.
You know,
and that was done.
They're Bond villains.
They're Bond villains, and that was done clear up into the 60s in film. I mean, the people are always asking why. Why did you do this? And so there always has to be that monologue, that dialogue, that soliloquy, whatever it happens to come across as. It always has to be given. And that's why Iago is such a standout character. And it's because of reading Shakespeare and because of understanding these characters, as paper thin as you think they are, which they're some are, some aren't, I can see that in modern life. And I can see that in modern books. And I can see a lot of Shakespearean moments, and I can go, okay, this is exactly how this is going to play out. And it's because of reading and because of literature that I was able to do this. So that's why I'm saying I'm all for it, and I don't care what you read, just read. And when the bug does bite you, which it will, study the classics. You don't have to enjoy them, but study them.
The thing I want to finish this episode off with is find books by Clive Barker, Harlan Ellison, Ray Bradbury, William Gibson, Philip K. Dick, Robert Heinlein, Richard Matheson. Find books by these people.
Bruce Sterling, Neil Gaiman.
Right. I was waiting for you to. Yeah. I'm kind of like jump in anytime.
Yeah.
You know, yes, these might be the big names, and there's, you know, Chuck Palahniuk.
Yeah.
I mean, Chuck Palahniuk actually, to me, revolutionized because his writing style was so unlike anything I'd read before, yet was still weirdly pop culture.
Yeah.
If you haven't read Chuck Palahniuk, you've only seen the movies, read his books.
Yes.
They are fucked up. And he took chances. Maybe this had been done before, but there was one that started at chapter 54 and worked backwards to to chapter one. I'd never seen that done in a book before. Yeah. That shit's brilliant.
Yes. Also, I can't remember his names, but he wrote Microsurfs and J-Pod.
I don't know.
Those are two books that you have to read. Even the audio doesn't do them credit. But we're out of time, but I hope we opened your eyes to some literature.
Beyond the Star Trek novels and the Xena novels and the Buffy novels, and try to read something a little more substantive is my point of
and
this.
And at least get the cliff notes on the classics. So thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next week.